from the Independent Producer Project and KCRW.com. I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional, a program of true stories, personal documentaries, and radio movies. There have always been the epic adventurers, a type of person for whom athletic competition or endurance challenges are just not enough. Their achievements can only be spoken of in monumental terms.
We should never, ever give up.
A swim over 100 miles long, or a jump from the stratosphere, or a trip alone across three oceans by rowboat.
God damn it, and it is the same goddamn game this ocean has been playing with me since October. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know when this is going to end. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
That's the voice of Turkish-American Erdin Arush, who became the first person to ever travel completely around the Earth alone and under his own power. Cycling, hiking, but especially rowing. He set a lot of rowing records, and the expedition took him 5 years overall, including breaks for weather, rest, and healing. But incredibly, his trip was only a part of a completely different expedition, which is still going on. He wants to climb the highest peaks of all six continents. He has three so far. Most expeditions on this largest scale are bankrolled by major sponsors, usually some energy drink or a clothing label, and the adventurer is followed by media, video and support boats. But when he was out on the ocean, Erdin Arush traveled alone, and he used his own money to pay for the trip. He emptied his savings, and he sold the condo where he lived with his wife. And by the end, he rode over 23,000 miles. But in all that time away, relationships with his wife and his friends had changed. And in his mind, Erdin Arush was still on his expedition. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional and Solo Man.
It is just short of 6:30, and it is the 10th of July, Tuesday morning. Fishermen coming back last night were reporting calm conditions out at sea. It's calm, calm, calm. This is it. This is when I commit and I get out there. Hope to make good progress due west. This is it. Finally, the time is here.
My name is Erdin Arush. I've been a traveler and adventurer since 2002. What I wanted to do is circumnavigation of the world. Starts and ends at the same place. Goes around the world in generally the same direction. Also passes through a pair of diametrically opposite points that are antipodal to each other. Quickly learned that I should not share this idea with many people. The reaction that I got from most was, have you done anything like that before? And I postponed it. I had to have all the answers to all my questions and all my worries, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. What's going to happen if I leave? Can I succeed? Can I pay for this? Do I have the time? Do I have all the answers? I did not. I kept reading. I kept gathering maps, charts, to try to basically map the path forward. And while I had some answers missing, I could not move.
More than 5 years before he started his round-the-world journey, Erdin met fellow adventurer and mountain climber Göran Kropp. Erdin liked his way of doing things.
He had bicycled from Stockholm to Nepal on his own so that he would reach the summit of Everest under his own steam from his doorstep. There was a book about him called Ultimate High. I had read that book. I said, I need to talk to him. He asked me the first two questions. When are you starting? Do you have sponsors?
That's land, 42 miles. East of me, that's Bodega Bay. It's wonderful progress. I can boogie down south. I'm happy. And I'm not seasick either.
Erdin Arush and Göran Kropp became friends and climbing companions. And in 2002, they met in Washington State to go rock climbing.
We made an appointment to go meet in Frenchman Coulee on a route called Air Guitar. We were high-fiving, talking about what we would do in the future together. It was getting to be chilly and cloudy. It was a cold September day. He was reaching the top of the climb. He may have had just another arm's length from the anchors. And when I heard noise above, I looked up and I could see him falling. My wife was traveling during that time and she received a call.
I heard his voice in the distance. He said that, yes, there was an accident, that Yoron fell. I started to shake. I remember that.
We don't know why he fell. We only know that his system failed.
When Yoron fell, Erden was his belayer, the person who guides and controls the ropes for a climber above him.
Out of six or seven pieces that he had placed on that route, only one remained in the crack. So it was a catastrophic failure of his safety system. He didn't come to a stop until he hit my ledge, then fell off onto the path below.
This person who was larger than life in our lives falls to his death on his watch, on his belay. And even as I recall it now, I can feel the emotion of that day. This was a Tuesday. It happened on a Tuesday. And on the following Friday of that week, we went out to look for the equipment that had failed and to try to piece the story together.
The accident site was still fresh, and where he had laid last, there were some stones that still had his blood on them. There was one that was soaked in his blood, entirely covered. I decided that I had to pick that up and keep it. And that's still with me today. It's a reminder that life was passing me by. I had to get going. So quickly, I made a decision coming back from his funeral.
It was on the way back.
I drew the world map on the proverbial napkin. And I said, I'm going to go around the world.
And dedicate that to Yoron.
She said,
he had to.
You have to do this now.
He had to put it in motion.
There were no excuses anymore. We cashed out my 401k. And then we downsized our home. We had a condo facing Lake Union. We sold that and then moved away from downtown Seattle so that we could live on one salary. I was not going to wait for sponsors to catch up with me. And I had to lead the way.
He couldn't just talk about it anymore.
I had never taken the first real step toward the journey of 1,000 steps, if you will.
5 years ago today, Yoron fell. And he had encouraged me to get started on my journey. There was nothing that he could do nor I could do to stop his fall. I was his belayer, and that was a turning point for me. After that point, I made the commitment to get started on my journey. Until then, I had been talking about it. I was looking for sponsors. When I failed to get the sponsorships, I was going to the next one, as if I were seeking their permission, their approval, their endorsement. This is just going wonderfully, and I know Yoron is watching.
Once I started, I committed everything. It became my reality. It became my life. I applied all my energy and resources to it. It was not about me. It was about the journey. And I became an engine for it. I pushed it and pulled it and controlled it.
Erden rode and rode, alone across the rough Pacific Ocean, southwest toward Australia. He rode through the rest of the summer into the fall, and he rode right into a particularly strong typhoon season.
La Nina conditions kicked in while I was on the ocean, changing the intensity of the winds along the equator.
It rained nonstop for 48 hours until yesterday afternoon when I got a brief spell of sun.
That's stronger than normal southeast winds.
I never thought that I would have this much goddamn rain in a row, day after day after day.
Day 100 is not any different than day 101.
This rain is hideous, it is evil, and I am sick of it.
I never got across the equator. I was driven west by the winds for months at a time.
Today is November 9, and I am absolutely frustrated. Overnight, I went 25 miles straight north. And then, since this morning, I have come 19 miles. And that would be a record day. 25 plus 19. That would be 45 miles in one day on anchor. What the hell is going on? There must be an eddy or something that is catching my boat and just carrying it north right now.
God damn it, and it is the same goddamn game this ocean has been playing with me all the way since October, and this is just insane. So I don't know where I'm going. I don't know when this is going to end. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I am not in charge. I am just biding my time at this point. This is stupid.
It seemed as if the nights were quieter than the day, but I might have been imagining that. I was able to turn inward and enjoy the challenge. I could hear a lot of details. I grew to learn those details eventually and distinguish them. As I was sleeping or resting in the cabin, I could keep up with what was going on around me. If I heard sounds outside, if I heard chirping, I knew that I had dolphins around. If I had a knocking sound like a door knock, I knew that it was a turtle trying to pick up barnacles under the boat. If it was a sandpaper sound, I knew that it was a shark rubbing its back on my boat. All of those things kept me aware of my surroundings. If I was out rowing at night, often I could see more stars than I would in the city. Of course, sometimes Venus would be so bright that the light would shimmer across the water all the way to my boat. And when the moon came up, it would just wash out all the stars, and it would be so bright it would be as if I had daylight. In the dark, as I rowed, I would have bioluminescence fire up at the tips of my oars, and I would leave pairs of puddles in the water as I rowed away from the disappearing ones in the distance that I had left behind. The waves, as they rolled, that mechanical action would excite the bioluminescence as well, and you would get these big mushrooms of hopping red glow in the water around me with a whoomp sound. I had to turn everything into a reward. For example, if I started rowing right at daybreak, as the sky turned from black to dark blue, I would be awake. And before sunrise, I would be done with breakfast and rowing. If I wanted to listen to music, I'd say to myself, well, in the afternoon, I need to keep rowing now. If I wanted that piece of energy bar or something that I liked out of the holds, I'd say, well, another 2 hours and you'll earn it. That small bottle of wine that I had tucked away, well, you're not going to get that until mile 1,000. Rowing across the Great Barrier Reef getting to the safe side on the inside the Great Barrier Reef was a challenge. There was this one opening where I had to pass through to the safe side. And when I reached that opening, I had ebb tide. The tide was against me. It wouldn't let me through. So I was stuck on the outside. There was a current that was running northwest, and the wind was from the northeast pushing me toward the reef. So I had to stay out all night. And the whole night I rode with the wind pushing me toward the reef. The sound was ominous. It was the sound of waterfall in the near distance. If I let go, nobody would know that I was there. To stay awake, I had coffee bags that I could dangle into hot water and make coffee. So I would rip those bags and toss the coffee grinds in my mouth, chew them, and drink water on top. I didn't have time to warm up any water. I had to just keep going.
Eventually, Ayrton made it to Australia, where he climbed the humble Mount Kosciuszko, the highest point in Australia, as part of his 6 points in six continents expedition. He cycled along the southern coast, and after a short break, he finally left in his rowboat once more, from Western Australia all the way across the Indian Ocean to Madagascar. He was alone on the ocean for 4 months, traveling over 5,000 miles. It was now well over 3 years since his expedition had started. There had been many long delays to wait out storms, and for Ayrton to try and heal his many injuries and his rapidly decreasing enthusiasm.
I hit Africa at a low point in my journey. I felt isolated, I felt alone, I felt abandoned, I felt that I was stretched to the limit. We decided that a safer route would be to pass close to the north end of Madagascar and then route southwest toward Mozambique following the currents. Piracy had been a concern. And as I neared Madagascar, I was practicing blackout at night. I was not spending any time on VHF radio. I was on listening mode on my AIS, which is an automatic information system that gives out the location of surrounding ships. The thing is, everybody was doing the same thing. They did not turn on any lights. I could see silhouettes of ships pass by. I could have been a bump in the road for any one of these ships, and had they run into me, they wouldn't know I was there. So it was a risk that I had to take to stay invisible as much as possible. So I got lucky.
And then at the end, I must return alive because there's a story to be shared.
When he hit the coast of Mozambique, Ayrton Arush switched to a bicycle and rode north to Tanzania, where he climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. He climbed with his wife Nancy and his father and a group of friends. As punishing as these land sections of his journey were, at least he saw some familiar faces sometimes. Then he took a difficult ride southwest through Africa to Namibia, where he crashed his bicycle many times, and then a break to prepare. And finally, Ayrton Arush set off to row his boat across his third ocean, the Atlantic, and he was once again alone.
I didn't mind isolation. Rather than isolation, separation was a big challenge because it tasked our relationship with Nancy as well.
6 months at sea also means 6 months of separation from Nancy. This is as much a challenge and an ordeal for her as it is for me.
Just trying to explain that, to justify that, and to negotiate that back and forth over satellite phone that costs us money. Every time we did anything, it cost us money, and that was part of the conversation as well. And doing that over satellite phone, which cost us more money, was just not making sense. It just was not the right medium to do it, and it was spiraling out of control.
In any marriage, there's always going to be somebody who feels like they're not being appreciated. They're taken for granted. And having an adventuring husband floating in the ocean for months at a time, Nancy had to fight off some of those feelings.
I could have gotten myself all caught up in he's gone and I'm by myself and all of that, but that's no way to live. And I was never going to cope with this long term if I felt sorry for myself all the time. Every day I made a choice to stay there and support him in this journey.
I had committed all my resources, all my relationships, all my time to this journey. I had spent all of my funds, my time, and my energy to get it done. And after a while, it became a challenge that seemed like only I cared about.
I have no idea where I will land, when I will land, when I will see Nancy. This thing is getting to be a drag. Right now, the joy is gone. This has turned into a punishment and an unhappy existence. I just don't have words for it. This is bull. I miss Nancy.
He was out there physically having a journey as well as a spiritual and emotional journey, but I was also having my own. There were very few, if any, people I knew. I did some research to say, hey, how many spouses of adventurers are out there in the world, and do they have anything in common with me? And I was searching to find wives of explorers, and I kept coming up against these women who were also adventurers, and I thought, darn it, that's not me. But I, you know, I was looking to find partners of people that stayed home and sort of kept vigil and kept the base camp going and all of that. I really found that probably the closest thing to what I experienced were partners of people that went off to war.
We were bleeding money. We had to get it done. If I did not finish, I would have nothing. I had received no coverage, no support, no sponsorship, and finishing it was going to be the only saving grace in this.
The toughest part of this for me, so it took over just over 5 years. I have to say the first 4 years were manageable, at least for me. The last year was the most difficult. That last year took its toll.
I had to push to the finish line, and Nancy wanted me to return home, but I could see the finish. We had promised that I would finish, and everybody was going to be there to see me finish. And then 69 days later, I reached Louisiana, Cameron, Louisiana. Received my bicycled southwestern USA all the way to Bodega Bay again, where I had started. 5 years, 11 days later, I came to the same spot where I had launched. It was a stressful finish. It was almost getting dark, and fog was rolling in. Bodega Bay is where they had filmed Birds. Scary movie, right? So there was this aura descending on Bodega Bay. Is he going to make it? That was the big question. In that cold, damp ocean fog, as they were waiting, I appeared at the opposite end of the bay and circled around and came to finish. Only about maybe 30 folks were there. Friends that cared.
After 5 years, the journey's coming to a close.
Thank you. Where are my friends over here?
Yeah.
Give me a hug, man.
And once I got to the finish line, I realized I had been gone for so long that everybody had moved on. Children, my friends had grown up, they had new lives. And dealing with the aftermath of that separation, the results of that separation, trying to negotiate that time away, if you will, was the biggest challenge. I think it was harder than the journey itself.
So here's a man who was alone at sea and alone on expedition most of the time, and yet he felt more alone in many ways when he came back.
Just when I thought I could relax and settle in my own bedroom, looking up at the same ceiling with the same crack in the wall.
We had to figure each other out again, and we had to maybe do a little bit of a different dance with each other and figure out who each other was, and yet also be patient. That's where we are now. So we're still together, you know? We're still together, and we're finding our way through this experience, and we both have chosen that we still want to be together.
I think of her as the foundation upon which I thrust forward.
I don't think any marriage is easy. I don't think any marriage that may seem ideal on the outside is necessarily as rich and is filled with the kinds of experiences that he and I have had. Am I going to choose to stay and support him and be, you know, be that partner that I was all along? And so far, I can tell you that I've chosen to be that partner.
We're making the best of the time together that we have.
So it's been 3 years now that he's been off the expedition, and sometimes I would look at him and I'd say, where are you? Are you on expedition? And in his mind, he was. But I can usually tell by the look on his face, or, you know, he's glancing off into the distance, that he's really out on the ocean.
I find myself wanting to get on a journey again. That's part of my struggle. And Nancy knows that. She's not going to stop me if I want to get on an ocean again.
Well, what are you going to do? You're going to try to hold him down? You're going to try to hold him back? I mean, I like it all the time, but I'm going to be okay.
Life is short, and I need to live it fully. I can define myself around the journey. I can become the journey. I am that person now, a nomad, a transient.
That story was produced by Alex Ashley, an independent radio producer based in Bellingham, Washington, with mix, music, and sound design by me, Bob Carlson. You can find photos of Erden Arouche from his rowing journey, plus lots of other information about his round-the-world expeditions and his nonprofit organization. It's at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. That's also where you can listen to all the past editions of this program and sign up for the podcast and that sort of thing. Oh, and you should know that there are still tickets available for Unfictional Live. It'll be an intimate storytelling night as part of Riot LA in downtown Los Angeles. It's on Saturday, January 21st. Get tickets at kcrw.com/events. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The associate producer is Carla Green, and the editor is Nick White. We're on Twitter at Unfictional and Facebook, but mainly, I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from kcrw.com.